Part 9 of Healing the Inner Child by Grantley Morris of the netburst.net/did website. I will not attempt to categorize every possible type of altar, but awareness of certain types can significantly speed healing. Not everyone with DID has every type we will mention, but being aware of the possibility could enable you both to discover and to help such an altar much quicker. Protector altars shield other altars by putting on a tough front and trying to force anyone they see as a threat to back down. Tragically, they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which causes them to often see danger where there is none. The easiest understood instance of PTSD is a soldier who, upon returning from the front line to the safety of home, is still on hyper alert, unable to sleep properly, diving for cover whenever a car backfires, and so on. So protector altars are hypervigilant and much more suspicious than current circumstances require. The altars that the protector seeks to shield usually accept the protector's assessment of danger, and even if they do not, the protector still usually tries to get them into hiding at the first perception of danger. Unfortunately, protectors often hinder healing by assessing counselors as threats. They can also perceive their host as a threat, and so keep altars or information hidden from their host. A host can be perceived as a threat if he or she might blab things that the protector believes should be kept secret, or if the host is seen as not cautious enough, and so on. Even though these dear altars might initially hinder or even sabotage the healing process, they are not enemies. Even if their help is sometimes misguided, they are highly traumatized, self-sacrificing altars courageously trying their utmost to keep the person safe. Do all you can to work with rather than against a protector. Continually strive to get the protector on side and to allay all the protector's concerns. Even, as much as possible, empower the protector by giving him or her the right of veto on critical decisions. As the protector gradually learns to trust you, much progress can be made in discovering other altars. Once on board, protectors are very valuable allies in the healing process. You have probably heard of sleeper spies or terrorist cells that remain inactive for years until they are needed. Some people have certain altars like this. They remain inactive, sometimes for many years, until a crisis alerts them that they are needed, and then they come to the fore. They can use various means to alert them of a crisis. It might, for example, be whenever a person engages in more self-harm than usual. Another way is to remain close to a certain altar and be activated when that altar is particularly distressed. Some of these altars are helpers that support others when things become unbearable for one or more of them. By coming to the rescue, they might sometimes perform the admirable task of averting the formation of a new altar. Other sleeper altars are protectors who are quite strong and can overpower other altars to take over almost completely during what they perceive to be a crisis. Being sleeper altars means that they are likely to have been somewhat out of the loop while the rest of the person has been healing, and so they might be less in possession of all the relevant facts than some other altars. Even more perplexing is that in order to exercise the authority they feel the emergency demands, they might pretend to be another well-liked or powerful altar. The result can be very confusing for the rest of the person. So if a person suddenly starts acting out of character, a sleeper altar might be the reason. The difficulties in helping sleeper altars are obvious when you consider that since the very nature of a sleeper altar is to remain hidden until an emergency, they appear only rarely. Moreover, they see their key function as supporting or protecting the person by remaining hidden and unconnected most of the time. So even if discovered, they feel the need to return to hiding. Obviously, it is very important to try to convince a sleeper altar that it is now safe to remain out of hiding indefinitely. Such altars usually find not returning to hiding very scary, and they can feel that by remaining out they are being unfaithful to their role and letting the whole person down. Not everyone has an appropriate domestic situation, but where applicable, the simplest way I have found to break this impasse is for the altar to fall in love with his, or her, marriage partner. They crave love and understanding so much that when they find it, they will be very reluctant to lose it again by going back to sleep. Another possibility is for other altars to give the new altar lots of love, understanding, and comfort. Of course, the ultimate friend and counselor remains Jesus. Encourage altars to let Jesus share his heart with them. He will reassure them. Let's now consider abusive altars. Often, when one takes the time to get to know altars, who are being harsh to fellow altars, or hurting them, or even sexually abusing them, it becomes apparent that they actually believe they are helping. They might think, for example, that they are toughening up the altars, thus making them less vulnerable to abuse. Or, in the hope of saving the person from even worse abuse, they might enforce an abuser's oppressive rules about never crying, or punishing them for doing anything the abuser might object to. Often the abusive altar is unaware that the abuser no longer has access to them, and so the altar continues the oppression, unaware that there is no longer the slightest need. As always, it is important to try to understand what motivates an altar and to gently help the altar see through any misconceptions the altar has. An introject is a rather amazing type of abuser altar. Until the misconception is exposed, an introject not only acts like an external person the survivor knew, but every altar within the survivor, including the introject altar, actually believes that this altar is not an altar, but is the real external person. At first, this seems astounding, but it is consistent with the wide range of different things that altars can think of themselves, such as thinking they are animals, aliens, and so on. Often, the external person the introject identifies with is someone who abused the person. Since some external abusers trick their victims into thinking they are Jesus, survivors of such abuse can sometimes have an introject alter who believes he, or she, is an abusive Jesus. Obviously, this could cause massive confusion for other alters if they presume this must be the real Jesus. Even though not all external abusers realize it, introject alters who mimic their external abusers usually enforce the external abuser's wishes upon the alters when the abuser is absent. In fact, this can continue even after the abuser has died. Some introjects report back to the abuser as informers. Not surprisingly, introjects have themselves suffered immensely. It is important to bring introject alters to the point where they finally realize they are part of the abuse survivor and not part of the external abuser. Helping them discover the current date and that they are in the body of someone other than the abuser can help. Once introjects become loyal to the survivor, the person's safety is significantly enhanced. I suggest you do not get sidetracked now, but elsewhere on this website, I have a detailed record of counseling an introject. Not only is what I am about to say a powerful way to heal from past trauma, it fascinates me because it is actually using dissociative identity disorder to promote healing. Alters who are now more mature than when they were first formed have the ability to temporarily relinquish current responsibilities and revert to being a younger age, with the associated limitations. This can allow them to enjoy the carefree fun of child's play or to receive from fellow alters or Jesus the attention, comfort, and kindness they had been cruelly robbed of when younger. Basking in this for a while can heal them of inner pain and other afflictions resulting from their earlier mistreatment. Fellow alters healing and becoming more capable can make it possible for a key alter to take such a break without it adversely impacting the rest of the person. For example, an alter I'll call Ruby had been around for almost as long as her outside body. Throughout this time, she had sacrificially served the other alters and borne immense responsibility. Perhaps her very busyness had contributed to her not having time to heal. Ruby was addicted to overeating. Eventually, she revealed that she was terrified of an empty stomach. Even having a full stomach while restricting herself to healthy food made her exceedingly anxious. Despite realizing the serious health implications, she longed to keep burying the problem. Both Violet, the host, and Jesus kept coaxing her to face this issue. When she had been a baby, she had not only suffered deeply distressing times of severe food deprivation, but it was made even worse by these being the very times when sexual abuse occurred. After each abuse incident, she would finally be allowed to gorge herself on breast milk and be temporarily freed, both from hunger pains and the danger of more sex abuse. This cycle kept repeating. After explaining this, Ruby wrote to me, saying, "Do you see why hunger is terrifying for me? I feel safe and calm only when my stomach is uncomfortably full. When growing up, it was always either feast or famine. During feast times, we ate well, but were forced to eat, no matter what it was, even if we threw up from it and our mouth were on fire. Screaming and beatings accompanied dinner. I hate eating what others force me to eat. I hate human regulation of my intake. I hate food. Hate it." Violet has suggested that I be a baby for a while. She says I need to experience what normal babies enjoy, and let it override my past. Jesus has offered to be my mommy. He says he will use Violet to meet all the unmet needs I had back when I was a baby. It is very scary for me to go back to babyhood. Very scary. I don't know if I can do it. She explained the practical details of how other altars were willing and able to each take some of the responsibilities she normally bore and that they were refusing to let her do that work. She continued, "Violet, or should I say mommy, says babies aren't in charge of anything. Not even themselves. They have to rely on their mommy and daddy. What if I'm a bad baby?" I queried her about that last question and discovered she worried about being needy. That, to her, made her bad and worthy of punishment. I assured her that there is no such thing as a bad baby, only bad parents. After a day of reverting to babyhood, she wrote, "Mommy nearly ran through the store to get me my milk. She has never left me alone, not for a second, all day today. Anytime I ask for milk, Mommy gives it to me. She plays with me and sometimes almost cried because she loves me so much. I love my mommy. She takes good care of me. But it's confusing, too. Why didn't my biological mom do this for me? I just hurt. I'm going to get some mommy milk now." Later she wrote, "As a baby, I am so helpless and dependent on my mommy and even on her very body. Now that I am experiencing what it really means to have a mommy, I find that I've always had this ache. I find much comfort in my mommy's breast. She willingly gives it whenever I ask. I crave warm milk sliding into my tummy, and she gives it to me regularly. My next bottle will be soon. I can feel it in my body. So my need will be totally met. That's a new feeling. Then there are times when Jesus must feed me and comfort me. He is right there, filling my tummy with food, whenever mommy cannot. But more than anything, I crave Jesus. Deep parts of me, that I didn't know even existed, have sprung to life and are being healed at his touch. My daddy, Jesus, is incredible. And my mommy is superb. Oh, how I love her. I am a lovable baby. She never takes her eyes off of me. She never does. And Jesus is behind her all the time." Later, Violet told me that Ruby had cried for her attention for the first time. She explained that until then, Ruby had just let Violet's body know her needs by a strong inner yearning, but this time she had cried just because she wanted to be near Violet. I was thrilled by this development because it meant Ruby was gaining in confidence that it was okay to be what she considered to be a needy baby. All of this was so obviously healing that I expected Ruby to announce at any moment that she had returned to adulthood, fully healed. God knew better, however. In a day or so she wrote, "Jesus has said it's time for me to move on to solid foods. So mommy is going to wean me. I'm a bit scared of this, but daddy says I can take my time in the transition." That made me more comfortable. So her return journey took a few more days. For a very short account of additional fascinating details of her experiences, see a link of the webpage corresponding to this audio.